Where do partnerships fail? One, expectation management. So the challenge with a partnership is everyone sets lofty expectations that aren't met and blame each other. And coming in with the mindset of most people come into a partnership saying, what do I get out of this partnership? Mm-hmm. Most people do that when they get married. Like, I'm marrying this person to get a whole bunch of stuff, to get my meals made, to get money, most people don't enter into partnerships to say, how much can I give you? All right. So the first thing is, and all my partners, it's always been, how much can we give each other? How much can we sacrifice?
Welcome to Partnership Plus, your go-to source for modern partnership wisdom with your host, Phil Hayes St. Clair.
Everyone, a real privilege to spend some time with a guy that many people will know as Christian. More people know him as Boo. And Christian and Boo and I have spent a little bit of time together over the last number of years following each other and understanding the backgrounds of our different trajectories. Boo comes from a very unique one. He has a story that started from a very young age, wanting to be a fighter pilot, turned into a fighter pilot, and then had all these fantastic chapters. So, Boo, we're going to dive into those. We're going to talk a lot about the partnership mindset. And first of all, thanks for being here. I'm in Sydney and you are in Miami.
Thanks, man. You really have a voice for radio, Phil. I never even noticed it before until this podcast. You should be on, should be like a feature podcast on Kyle and Jackie or something. Mate, you know, great to be here. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Most welcome. I think we'll keep it on the download, but I would love to be one of those cartoon character voices in films.
I think you could be on The Family Guy. You know, I could easily see you there.
That's a completely different podcast, but we'll get to that as well.
A different version of Troy McClure.
Mate, let's talk a little bit about your backstory.
I think you've got that in space.
Let's talk a little bit about your backstory. What is your backstory from the very young age of 6, where you decided that you wanted to be a fighter pilot, all the way through to where you are today as the chief executive of Afterburner?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, so many people have this challenge with finding purpose in life, right? And so I guess some people, and I'm one of them, and there's a lot of fighter pilots are like this. It sort of finds us when we're very young. Normally, similar to my experience, our dad takes us to an air show. I went to one up in Amberley outside of Ipswich in Queensland. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the late 70s. And I still just have a vivid memory of it. I can't remember anything else from when I was 5. But I can remember everything about this day, the green grass, the fact that it was just one of those fantastic Brisbane summer days that was devoid of humidity, the smell of the jet fuel as the airplanes taxied past. And in those days, you could be right up against the runway, the brown and green of the F-111. The Hornet was kind of brand new. It was, you know, there's Mirages, P-3RI, just everything about it that would just... I still remember, and I think, you know, that to have that tangible a memory of something, as I reflect back on life now as the CEO of Afterburner, I've got to try and bring two worlds together, right? I've got to bring fighter pilot mindset, ways of working into business, and the first thing people say is, "What on earth can you do for me? You're a fighter pilot, you're military." So now I look back on it, I'm trying to unpack this whole journey, right? And I look at it and I go, "Well, that was really it. I mean, that wasn't wanting to become a fighter pilot. That was when I was imbued with a belief that I was going to be one. In moments of self-doubt, I didn't think I could make it due to my own personal performance limitations.
Sure.
But I always believed that it was what I was meant to be. And there was a few moments in my career where, you know, the scales were tipped. I almost didn't make it. But I think that belief in wanting it and bending people to my belief system and what I felt I should do was what tipped the balance into success. And I think for a lot of business owners and a lot of people, particularly entrepreneurs or those who are selling new things, their belief is what tips people over the line to
to
invest $50 million in something, right? So, and really, it's a dream. You know, it's like being a fighter pilot is for most people, it's a dream thing. There's a few fighter pilots that kind of finished uni and said, I want to be a fighter pilot, and they joined, you know, as something to do, and then became, you know, part of the fabric of it. But most fighter pilots have a dream. And I think what's really cool about the system that fighter pilots have is it takes pretty average people. And I was pretty average at school. Or, you know, I was pretty average at sport. I was pretty average at everything. I wasn't below average, and I wasn't especially above average. I was just average. And to take people like me and turn them into pretty phenomenal operators of equipment and really outstanding humans at getting stuff done. You know, the fighter pilot, most fighter pilots can get more done in a day than people get done in a week, right? And I think what, as I reflect on it, what's really different about fighter pilot mindset is bringing in this intentionality around everything. The whole, you know, I remember seeing Simon Sinek when he first came out with Start With Why. And I think for most of us in the Air Force, we're like, well, no shit. Yeah, that's, of course, that's the mission objective. That's exactly what you do. You know, Carol Dweck, you know, brought out mindset and talks about curiosity and a growth mindset. You look at that as a fighter pilot, you're like, yeah, that's our life. That's what we do. Why is this a book? And then through Afterburner, and we've worked with 3,500 companies. You know, I do about 100 odd events a year, including consulting engagements and huge project work. As you realize, actually, most people just don't think that way. Most people have no idea how to change the talk track, the self doubt, the self limiting beliefs, the ability to set and achieve an intention. I think for most of us, we're so used to wanting stuff and never getting it that we just live we basically give up before we even start. So from my backstory, you know, I got from 5 years of age to 21 years of age, 16 years it took me, and I finally flew a Hornet, F-18 Hornet in Australia for the first time solo. And again, I still remember that vividly as well. A really stormy day.
I can imagine. Yep.
Just me in this massive airplane all by myself. It was pretty cool. And then, you know, I spent from there another 9 years in the Air Force before I was medically discharged. And whilst I was a fighter pilot, I wasn't particularly thoughtful around why do we do it this way? And, oh, let me dissect. I mean, I just did it, right? As fighter pilots, we're action orientated. We follow the bouncing ball. There's a system in place. But now I'm out of the Air Force and I use the cognitive models and systems that fighter pilots used in business. I now see how elegant it is. And it's elegant because it's simple, but more importantly, it's a system that was engineered in an environment where lots of people died. Lots of people were killed. Not even in combat, just doing your job, just flying the airplane. You know, crashing on landing, wheels not coming down, engines exploding. So take combat out of it. Thousands of pilots were killed just because of the machine and aviation being a dangerous environment. So when you look at all the different operating models that companies use, whether it's Lean Six Sigma, whether you look at it as Agile, Scrum, you name it, every one of those systems was designed without the consequence of death. And therefore, is probably not as simple and elegant as it could be. And part of, you know, my journey now is to prove up our model against all the other models in modern neuroscience to demonstrate that no matter how you test this system, it always works. It creates clarity, it creates awareness, it removes stress, minimum effort for maximum outcome. You know, in any environment, any business at work. So the backstory is the fighter pilot. The mid story is a business founder. And the final chapters of the book now are trying to impart, you know, this wisdom as broadly as we possibly can.
Yeah, I don't think there are too many final chapters happening here. It feels like there's plenty of new chapters being opened. Tell me about, as we're doing research for this episode, we were looking at your time out of the Air Force into Afghanistan. And I use that carefully because this was a time before modern conflict. Obviously, Afghanistan has had conflict for many, many, many generations. But you started a humanitarian organization that seems like it was quite a profound and pivotal time in your life as you started to explore a non-military career.
Yeah.
We're
talking before about military, and to clarify, fighter pilots, we're in the military by default, but we're not military. We had to create a different operating model, different way of working because of that. And that's no disrespect to the military. Obviously, the military, no matter what they do, it's very, very effective. But
yes,
fighter pilot mindset introduces something very unique, and that's speed and information. A very, very fast moving environment and vast amounts of information to compress, and those are two mutually exclusive events occurring simultaneously. Mm. Whereas the rest of the military, like business, is a bit slower. It's walking, running, driving, boating, whatever it is. So, but anyway, that's an aside. Firstly, fascinating about Afghanistan is as you drive around Afghanistan and working in that environment, the remnants of centuries of war and conflict in that place. Multiple empires were broken in Afghanistan, whether it's the British Empire, the Mongolians, Alexander the Great, the Russians, the Ottomans. Everything you see in Afghanistan highlights the fragility of these myths and civilizations that we create as human beings. And what you realize there is people are just people. We're all human. Who cares about the religion? Who cares about your beliefs? Everything is a program. And we are a program and a product of our environment. You take a person born in Afghanistan and they popped out in Australia with the same genetic coding, they would be totally different humans purely based on the programming, right? So part of what we did, the reason I went to Afghanistan was pretty simple. I love being a fighter pilot. I got to as far as I could as a fighter pilot, a mission commander, and the next phase was really moving into the leadership roles and squadron commander. But I was unfortunately, for many years in the Air Force, I suffered a lot of pain in my spine, in my legs, a lot of headaches, and I just thought it was a function of the high G environment, because most pilots are complaining they've got neck pain, they've got, you know, a bunch of fighter pilots yourself, mate. They're all kind of got painful memories of flying around at 7.5 G with a 15 kilogram bowling ball that's your head. So I just thought it was just natural, but what it actually was an autoimmune disorder called ankylosing spondylitis. So your immune system effectively attacks the healthy tissue, which is the soft tissue between your bones. So for me, my level of pain was like a factor of 10. I just didn't know. And eventually my neck froze and I got a whole bunch of medical tests. And I was kicked out of the Air Force. So, you know, I'm only 30 years of age now. I've been in for 11 years. And I'm like, man, what does one do now? And I didn't really want to be an airline pilot. I only wanted to be a fighter pilot. And I thought I'll get into business. But I didn't really know anything about business. It seemed pretty competitive in Australia. So all I could really think of was, if I want to be successful, I have to go somewhere where I'm unique and where I'm needed. And it was either Iraq or Afghanistan, right? 2005, both of which were in, you know, post-war reconstruction mode. So I met a guy when I was in England. I was flying in the Royal Air Force. I flew an aircraft called the Tornado. I met an army captain there, a guy called Tom, who became, you know, my best mate. And he and I just went to Afghanistan. He went first, got the lie of the land. And then I remember we had our first contract opportunity, and I bought two Akubras, two RM Williams boots at the size of the client we're gonna work with. Landed in Kabul, met these guys, gave them the Akubras, gave them the cowboy boot, and we won a $6 million contract as our first contract. And I'm like, okay, this is good. This business stuff is fun. And moved to Afghanistan, lived in a little pensioni villa kind of thing It was actually also a home for women who had been victims of acid attacks. It was a beauty salon, but so many women there had suffered this misfortune that they would come here, they would train them up as beauticians, and they were like incredible, incredible beauticians. And we grew, and we ended up getting a big compound, and we had staff, and we had thousands of staff after about 4 years. But what was interesting about it, and I didn't realize at the time, was just the way of thinking that we're taught as fighter pilots, you know, what am I trying to achieve here? What's my current result? Why am I not there yet? And what can I do in the next 24 hours to inch closer? Mm. And just constantly applying that. You know, we co-founded a company that had the first ambulance service in Afghanistan. We created the first mortuary in Afghanistan. So we were repatriating people who closed the final chapter of their lives and got them back home again. We were populating camps. We were auditing and doing quantity surveying work for major UN projects. I mean, we just kind of did everything. And the reason we did everything was not, we didn't really have a plan and this is our product. We had a mindset, which is, what are you trying to do in Afghanistan? How's that going? Is there anything we can do to help? And generally the answer to that was, oh, yes.
Well, it's interesting. How can we help? The golden question, right? So can we double click on that for a minute? Because there is, and we'll go to this partnerships angle for a second. When you think about how you entered into, or you opened the opportunity or the specter of having a partnership with someone else, I can't tell you how many people just don't start with the option of saying, how can we help? So few people come in with a hard pitch. This is what we do, just so you know, not quite this, but take it or leave it, essentially is what you hear from the other side. Yeah. How did you go about forging, as somebody who was not native, enough of a strong relationship with all of these vendors, all of these different organizations, for them to trust you in order for you to do business with them?
Well, first and foremost, don't be a dickhead. So just don't try and be something that you're not. Secondly, is the great thing about being a fighter pilot is that brings a credential straight away. Like that's a benchmark. And it's a benchmark for me as well. When I see another fighter pilot, that's kind of a known quantity to me.
Yes.
And the good thing about Afghanistan was there's a lot of ex-military, a lot of ex-police first responders. So a lot of the people you're dealing with kind of knew what that was. So that was a trust accelerator in itself. The second was do your homework. So, and ask lots of questions. You know, don't be an expert, be curious. And through that, you start to discover, you know, the unspoken challenges in there as well. And in Afghanistan, I'll be honest with you, you have to be able to handle your beer as well, because there's a lot of socializing and a lot of functions. But equally, you know, doing that in a way where you don't overdo it either. You've got to be intentional even about that. You're not going out to network and have beers with everyone. You're doing it for the express purpose to learn, to increase your knowledge base, and then apply that to grow your business and adapt what it is you're doing. And I say this in my keynotes. I say the biggest deals I ever had, the easiest selling I ever did was in that business, because I didn't actually have a product. I didn't have anything that I was selling. Whereas after that, when I had products and companies that had very specific products and services, you can't help but just fall back on that. Oh, this is what I do, and this is how it's going to help you. Instead of saying, "How can I help you?" This is what I can do.
Yes,
it's human nature. We do this exercise at Afterburner, and it's doing this humanitarian mission, and basically the methodology we have at Afterburner, which is the same as the Air Force, is we say, "What's the mission? What's the threats? What have I got?" Okay. Business planning is, what's our goal? What have we got? How are we going to use it? No one actually does any problem statement. So what you find is, you see that human nature is very much, this is me, what do I do? Where do I fit in? Whereas the way that we approach it as fighter pilots is, here's the target, here's the problem. Actually, you probably don't even need me. Or I'm going to need to adapt what I do to make this work. So you're always bringing context to every conversation. And that context creates situational awareness. So, you know, with Afterburner, without doubt, the biggest challenge facing businesses, and it goes to what you talk about with partnerships as well, is everyone comes at every conversation from a perspective of, how do I fit into this? Mm-hmm. And if I don't, I'm going to get upset. Yes. And we spend so much time managing that bullshit. Whereas if you change the cognitive model and you have conversations slightly differently, people always feel included because there's always an opportunity for them to participate if they understand the problem that's trying to be solved. That's how you get rid of ridiculous meeting culture where you got 60 people on the call just in case you need me, where you get away from update culture, you know, and you stop getting into these habits where you're selling something that's becoming obsolete, or you start creating myths around the product and the market and start creating excuses. So that mindset into Afghanistan meant that company grew exceptionally quickly. Now, where the lack of business acumen and experience kicked in was this little thing called cash flow. And because we were in the human business and because we were doing primarily personnel and project work, because we were growing fast, we were able to feed the beast. But as the growth started to plateau, you know, we're paying staff on a fortnightly or 2 week basis. I realize in America that no one in America knows what a fortnight is, but on a 2 week basis, you know, we've got 90-day payment terms, and we're paying people and eventually we kind of lost control of the business and had to sell it into a multinational and pennies in the pound, which was disappointing from one level. We were the victims of our own success, and we were taken advantage of as kind of young 30-year-old guys who had no, you know, only come from the military where you just take everything at face value and you trust everyone, whereas business is not like that. Whilst it wasn't a tragic ending, it wasn't as good an ending as it could be. But the bottom line is we built that business from nothing. It never existed. We grew it to a multi-million dollar company, and the people we sold it to still own it today, and it's doing hundreds of millions of dollars worth of turnover still. We built that.
That's right. Every large company started as a small company at some point, and that's quite the story. When you think about the specific skill set, and I've heard you talk many times in your keynotes, but also in more private conversations about this notion of the debrief. And this is possibly one of the most valuable behaviors that I'm sure you're taught, which is not taught enough, because a lot of people think, oh, we'll get to it at some point. I'm keen to see how that played out in that Afghan experience, but more so as you've moved then into some construction, which was something quite extraordinary in its own right back in Australia, and then into the consulting and afterburner world. Let's talk a little bit about that review, after action review, post sortie review process, because it is absolutely fundamental to consistent high performance.
It's not taught anywhere else other than the Air Force. It's not taught anywhere else and habitually executed outside fighter pilot world. Not at all. Not in the transport pilot world, not in business. Ray Dalio is one of the very few, it's one of his core principles, radical candor, radical transparency. Yep. But by and large, you know, we've worked with the NFL. I did a lot of work with the NRL back in Australia. We're now working with the NBA. And people do reviews, but they're not intentional. Okay, and I'm in the process of proving this up. So this is a theory at the moment. Yeah, in that the way we learn best. Oh, look, when we study for an exam or we're at university, yeah, we know that if we read, we forget. If we write it down, we remember. And if we apply it, we understand it. Right. Yep. And debriefing is very much the same. Like if we just talk about what went wrong, we forget. The next day, we cram, you know, the latest Instagram feed into our head, but the thing about debriefing is the intentionality around it, the purposeful nature of it, and if you looked at it in a football context, the way footballs generally review their tapes is they'll have a match, they'll come back the following Monday or Tuesday, the coach gets up the front. There might be 30 plays that the coach reviews. The coach does all the talking. The coach tells everyone what they did wrong, and the coach tells them what they need to do next, right? And we call it the nodding no. All the players nod their head, but inside their brain, they're like, nothing's there's no computing. Whereas if you bring a cognitive model and you put it on the player, you put it on the person, the salesperson, the forklift driver, the QA person we work with. Yeah, we work with the team that makes Ozempic, the factory, the literally the most popular medicine on earth. And Afterburner helps them with process improvement. And what you realize is leaders take on the burden of performance. And what happens is people feel like someone's looking over their shoulder, that they're never doing anything right, mm-hmm. that the boss is always breathing down their neck, I'm under the microscope. You know all these words and phrases that are said, right? And the reason is because no organization has a peer review practice. There's plenty of meetings. There's plenty of time to have this. They just don't do it. We're giving people the opportunity to say, today, this is what I was meant to achieve. This is what actually happened. This is why I either overperformed or underperformed. And here's what I think I should do tomorrow. And here's what, and then the leader takes that and says, well, actually, that's the fourth time I've heard that in the last week. I think we should take that and turn it into an organizational action, not just. So leaders become more facilitative, and they have the freedom to think and not try and get inside everyone else's head and say, this is what you must have been thinking, this is what you were trying to do. Let the individual tell you what's going through their mind, and then you can course correct that. And the way it works on a fighter pilot debrief, and let's use the most complex example of a fighter pilot mission, right? I'm a mission commander. Whether it's in combat or in an exercise, my job is to lead maybe 50 airplanes into a target area against 20 to 30 bad guys, okay? Mm-hmm. I get a whole day to plan that. I have to plan it for me and my wingman, my formation of four, the package that we're a part of, the strike package, the air-to-air refueling, the guys that are doing all the intelligence and the radar picture. There might be some SAS guys that we're putting in on a helicopter or a transport airplane. There's like maybe 12 to 15 big moving parts and 200 small moving parts. Mm-hmm. And the mission commander is ultimately responsible for that. It has to get all of that stuff in and out within 5 seconds of the target, of everyone's agreed timing in three dimensions. And you're going to go land back at the same airfield and not run out of gas. In combat, in there, you've got to not get shot down as well and still get that done, right? So in that environment, when you debrief, you come back, highly complex, you've got no idea what's going on in the big picture, right, until it's over. No human can keep track of that much stuff. So you have to rebuild the picture. So you debrief yourself, you watch a video, all the stuff you did, and you go, this is where I was meant to be, this is what I was meant to do, I did it here, I didn't do it there. You write that down, you get together with your wingman, you both debrief together, then you two get together with the other two, there's four of you now. You debrief, and there might have been eight of you in the offensive counter air package, and then the eight of you debrief, and then you go back with the rest of the blue air, and the 20 of you debrief, and the 20 of you go back with the radar guy, and the 200 of you debrief, and then you come into the main room, and then the bad guys come in, and then you're debriefing with 400 people, and then you go back after the main debrief, and you debrief the eight, the four, boom. And you've done in a day maybe 16 debriefs in a matter of 2 to 3 hours. In a gazillion years, in a major program, in an organization, and I've done
never happened
$3 billion tech simplification programs at CommBank. We've just been engaged with Fannie Mae to help them execute their $4 trillion forecasting tool, because it's chaos. There are so many moving parts, and because no one's debriefing to connect intention to reality, it's just ambiguity reigns. It's just every now and again, synchronicity happens. Someone gets a kick in the ass. Everyone finally decides to come into the office and grind out a chunk of work, and we make a leap forward. So the thing about debriefing is it connects the three states of time in which execution occurs. It's called ORCA, which stands for objective, result, cause, and action. And what ORCA means is objective. So future state, what does the future look like? Result is, what's my current state? And there's plenty of current state in organizations. Like we're big data, man. There's like we can measure everything in an organization now. So we've got lots of R. Then we do C, which is cause. What's the cause of the gap between the objective and the result? And A is the action. Yeah, it doesn't get any simpler than that. What's my goal? Yep. What's my current result? What's the problem? No one has clarity around those goals, or they're very big, grandiose goal. Our goal is to go from a $1 billion revenue cloud security sales target to $10 billion in 5 years. Right. So what happens in the intervening 5 years? Like what do you need to be in the next quarter? And it's like crickets. People are like, like we'll go back and do some work, and then they come back and they're like, we need to be $2 billion. Like, $2 billion. In 6 months? Like you're going to get, you're literally going to double. Oh yeah, that's probably a bit optimistic, isn't it? What do you think it should be? I'm like, I don't know. I don't work here. I'm just like, it just doesn't make sense. And we just bring this ridiculously common sense approach, which is, and our philosophy is, you know, in this debrief, if I can understand what you're going to do after this debrief, the 30 people you lead will understand. If I don't understand, they might understand, but if you can say it in dumb fighter pilot speak, you're going to. So what inevitably happens out of a debrief is you discover that your objectives are vague, that maybe you're measuring the wrong things, and over time you grind it out and you start to really convert that $10 billion target into daily activities. And that's a process. Like that's a, you know, with a minimum of 90 days, we say, to get to form this habit. But, you know, companies that do that really embrace it and do this stuff experience profound growth. Like some of the businesses we work with have had such phenomenal growth. Yeah, it's pretty cool when the first sports team you ever work with, and this was the New York Giants for us in 2012, win the Super Bowl that year from the worst performing team to ever win a Super Bowl. And they credit debrief. Cool.
You know, it's funny. So two examples. I coach a under 12 women's soccer team, football team. And what we introduced to them at halftime was a mini debrief. Now, you've got 5 minutes with them. They're all sweaty. They're out of breath. They're having a war. They're almost tuning out. They're just trying to get a physical and emotional rest. And the question that we ask them is twofold. Number one, what have we done really well? And there'll be a few people that surrender an idea. And usually it's a little bit random, but we communicated well, we were passing well, we had some good shots on goal. But the thing where they always come very much alive, the questions asked immediately after, what can we do better in this next half? And straight away, at least half of the team hands go straight. They become used to me asking this question. Mm-hmm. But like you mentioned before, and not that we're there as coaches to micromanage, but you step out of it and all of a sudden the exchange happens and this even more common language between these young athletes starts to emerge, where it's not me trying to communicate as a 40-something-year-old white guy to these young girls what they should be doing. It's their language in their context, and they get even closer. And it's just been this past weekend, and we've had a huge season, but we haven't won anything yet. And I know it was grating on them, but it all clicked into play this last week, and they won their first game. And the look on their face and this complete elation, which essentially is the precondition to what the growth will happen next, I think can be credited to them having a shared language and having this way of exchanging and not bottling up the frustration. They could actually get something done. And it was an absolutely magical moment. And I know you've seen those in your career as well. When we talk about this in a partnership arrangement, right? So two CEOs or two senior leaders have decided, look, we can't do this all ourselves. They've also decided that they can express what their need is in a confident but somewhat vulnerable fashion because they've realized there's a change in market conditions. They've come together maybe privately with a few of their people, and they're having this debate and discussion. An arrangement is formed. And usually, at least in my experience, partnerships fail because everyone puts a huge amount of effort into getting a deal signed, and then nothing happens afterwards, right? It's sort of, we get to 6 months post deal, and there's a real problem. Yet in the partnerships that work really well, particularly in the first 6 months where the foundation's being laid because the people that signed the deal aren't really doing the work, they've got their other teams involved now. The ones that do quite well are the ones that seem to have two characteristics. One is that they meet quite regularly, often fortnightly in that first or two weekly. And the second thing is that they have a chance of going through that orca process. It's slightly different, but that orca approach is very important to them because they've started to work out what that shared language is. So if somebody is coming at this from a standing start and they don't have the benefit of having Afterburner and your team come in to have and explain this to them, what would you suggest they do in order to inspire this kind of cultural change mindset around installing or introducing the idea of a debrief, not just as a end of project, end of program initiative, but something that can be done quite regularly?
Yeah, it's, I mean, debriefing is a way of thinking, a way of working, and a way of communicating. It solves all of those issues. So the first, my personal experience is I have never owned a business without it being equal partnership, except for one, Australian Aviation. CTG was 50-50, me and Tom. The hotel was 50-50, me and Molyneux family. And Afterburner is 50-50, me and the founder. So I'm all in partnership. Where mm-hmm. do partnerships fail? One, expectation management, right? So the challenge with a partnership is everyone sets lofty expectations that aren't met and blame each other. And coming in with the mindset of most people come into a partnership saying, what do I get out of this partnership? Mm-hmm. Most people do that when they get married. Look, I'm marrying this person to get a whole bunch of stuff, to get my meals made, to get money, most people don't enter into partnerships to say, how much can I give you? All right. So the first thing is, and all my partners, it's always been, how much can we give each other? How much can we sacrifice? So that's key. Second is the way that our brain works in that. And if you look at fighter pilots and why we always have a wingman, right? In that, you're either busy doing or thinking. You can't do both. You can't meditate and play tennis, right? Yet we don't create that intentionality around our day as leaders, as business owners. We're so busy doing all the time that the time to think doesn't work. So part of the partnership model is, within that partnership, you have a doer. And I've been in different partner models. I've been the doer. So CTG, I was the thinker. Tom was the doer. Mm-hmm. With the hotel, I was the doer. John was the thinker. And I'm the doer again now with Afterburner, and Murph, the original founder, is the thinker. So you define those roles. Now, that doesn't mean it's 100% do and 100% think, but you understand that. And this is a little bit around leadership, when you have all these low authority leadership models, and a partnership is a zero authority leadership model, right? Is that the problem with low authority leadership and partnership is everyone wants to be the leader. Everyone wants to be the boss, and it doesn't work. You have to have dominant and submissive. You have to have the person make. So the best thing to do in a partnership is to define that really clearly and say, yeah, and we kind of do this in a, you know, if you think of a, you kind of do this in business to some degree, where you have a CEO and a COO, and you define the roles, but there's still some hierarchy in there. You can do that. You can do that in partnership. Where debriefing works really well is if something's not working and there's friction, or and objective and result is really what you're saying, is expectation and reality. So when expectation and reality are divergent, or they're not closing, or they're going the other way, the word debrief means we're going to go through a structured process with no emotion and nut this out for the benefit of everyone involved. And as a fighter pilot, you know that in a debrief, there's no blame, that there's no repercussions. It's nameless and rankless. Everyone's equal, because the goal is for everyone to win and learn in that forum. Because business and humans are all relationship-based and ego-based, and we bring the same philosophy to running a village as to running a business, we see it all the time. You see organizations that undergo org changes and restructures, and people have different roles and responsibilities, but the old relationships. So people, you might have been the store, you maybe used to manage the stores before, but now you manage technology. But because mm-hmm. all your relationships are store related, anytime anyone has a store problem, they still ring you, even though you're the technology person.
That's right.
And because you have the relationship, you don't want to let them down. So you end up doing your old job instead of the other person, and doing your job badly, and the organization just gums up, because fundamentally we're relationship driven. So to go back to the statement I made about the military and the Air Force and why it's different, in that the military is very hierarchical, rank and relationship driven. So is the Air Force. But we have to pull that away in air combat you can't operate on a relationship model. It's too fast. It's too dangerous. So the reason we call it plan, brief, execute, debrief, but the reason we create this iterative parallel system is to say that for not all the time, not all day, but there's portions of the day where we're going to park all that garbage, and we're just going to be really granular around our goals and our objectives, really granular, and make sure that what we're measuring in the business is linked to an objective. We're not just getting aberration numbers and making knee-jerk decisions based on, you know, uncorrelated data. And we're going to let our brains really engage in problem solving. So debriefing is iterative thinking. Iterative thinking is design thinking. So all these different words that everyone uses out there around, oh, we need a problem solving methodology, we need to bring some design thinking, all they're saying is we need to think smarter. We need to think critically. And that's what debriefing is. When it's structured, it's much easier because you're not sitting there saying, how do we do design thinking, and bring in, you know, someone who's a design thinking expert who has to make it complicated, or they're not going to get paid enough money. If it was, you know, we're a show and go. Like we come in for a day and we're out, and people accelerate their business on one day's worth of training.
Yep.
Big enterprise, tens, hundreds, thousands of people. Sure, we hang around for years, but you can have a profound moment of belief and a simple methodology, which is four steps, and take that away with you. So to loop that all the way around to partnership is expectation management. It's creating a debriefing mindset that means that we expect there to be shortfalls in expectation, but we're going to commit to each other to have structured conversations around that, where the goal is to close that. And even though this is the contract and how we're going to start the arrangement, the world's going to change around us, and we need to be flexible, but not based on our opinions of the environment and our opinion of what's right and wrong. The factual discourse we're going to have as a function of debriefing is going to drive those decisions and changes.
When you think about the exemplar of a business partnership, what comes to mind as something that really you sort of go back and go, that's how progress can be made when it comes to a business partnership?
When you have two meetings a week. On a Monday, you set the expectation. On a Friday, you debrief the expectation. And most of what the partners said they would do on Monday get done. You walk in a fighter squadron and you walk past another fighter pilot in the corridor and you say, hey, Phil, I need you to update the brick, what we need to go flying by 2 o'clock. Phil goes, yep, 2 o'clock, done. Perfectly, exactly what I need. There is no follow-up. There's no, will he get it done? Will she finish it? It's every single thing that comes out of someone's mouth is done. Or the answer is, no, I can't do it.
Clear expectation.
Yep. Yeah, it's like, I can work with that. What I can't work with is yes, and then you're freaking on leave or you've disappeared.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. What is a cautionary tale you would have for people about where a partnership fails in a mission critical environment? Could be flying, could be in your business experience. What's one that sort of burrows in the back of your mind and you sort of go, I never want that to be relived again?
Yeah, when we were bought out from CTG and we took minority shareholding in a new entity, and basically just got played. And it was a partnership in words, but not in documentation and not in expectation and not in terms of a partnership means both partners have access to the bank account. It's full trust, full stack trust from top to bottom.
Yep.
Both partners have access to the accountant. So every aspect of the business is completely open and transparent. Beware of and business uses it as well, like in a vendor relationship, we're partners. No, you're not. You're contracted vendor. So don't use the word partnership because you're setting everyone's going to feel let down because you're not partners. So because they don't see the markup you put on their product. A partner would. So if you're sitting there saying, "Hey, you're a partner, and we're screwing you on the price of strawberries," they're not partners. So that's the cautionary tale around a partnership is a partnership is a genuine. It's a marriage is the same. If two people are living obfuscated worlds, you're not in partnership. You're in coexistence. So that partners are partners. A wingman, a leader, everyone is aligned on the destination. Everyone is there to support at various stages. Someone has more knowledge than the other, so let them go. Watch each other's back, but always have each other's best interests and heart. And if someone doesn't understand something, open your palms, show them the books, and just be completely transparent.
I love that. We mentioned before we came on here that we both enjoy being partnership driven. In other words, we enjoy finding ways to do things together with other groups, other people, other companies. What do you think business leaders are missing right now, given how tumultuous the world is, markets are changing quite rapidly? What are leaders missing about the opportunity and the upside around entering partnerships?
I think there's a couple. I think a true understanding of what partnership is. I think the definition of partnership is maybe challenging. The complexity of the world, meaning, one of the things I always struggled with was, in an organization, when things are ambiguous, say for example, there's a big deal on the horizon, might transform the entire business, but it's ambiguous, and how you communicate that to a team. And I used to struggle with that when I first went into business, because I would just tell everyone everything like I would in a partner. But what I didn't realize was a lot of people would take that as red and go and buy a new car or go and do something, stupid. I realize how easily people can tell themselves stories to that meet their agenda. And often it'd be, and then I would be the bad guy because it was like, hey, it didn't come off. And I'm not an entrepreneur. So 9 times out of 10, what I'm talking about is going to happen potentially.
That's right.
Ain't going to happen.
Yep.
I know that, but the people, I learned that in my mind, what needed to be communicate was not what was happening, but the certainty around what was happening. So part of that is important, I think, in terms of leading and being a partner. It's like, it's like saying, be transparent, but a little bit like, the oversharing friend that kind of tells you everything. And, they'll be walking around and they'll be like, oh, I had a skid mark in my undies this morning. I don't really need to know that. There's a nuance around it, which I think is only experience can say. I think also in that the challenge with partnership is when something goes wrong, the badness isn't generally shared in partnership. It's absorbed by the person who was accountable for that. So for example, a CEO, when the results of an organization aren't where they should be, no matter how much they partnered at the C-suite, it lands on the CEO. So I think there's always a bit of protection and tin plating that goes on around that. And that, how you solve that, I'm not 100% sure. I mean, that's tough. that's the truth. And as a leader, you are there to protect your people. But at the same time, I think, you can still partner with them on decisions, on your curiosity, on learning. And if they respect you enough, they will share the burden of that as well. Don't throw people under the bus. Accept that people make mistakes. Again, the thing about debriefing is highlight the mistake, allow people to self-correct, course-correct, and keep going. Without debriefing, the quantum of mistakes can snowball. And what started off as a small mistake can turn into a billion-dollar one because no one just said, oh, this is dumb. We keep crafting a story around a reality. I think I love partnership. I Afterburner, when I bought it, was not a partnership model. It was a centralized system. My model is partnership, like as many people sharing the abundance as you possibly can, because that's where exponential growth is. I mean, you look at Apple now, right? Apple's a very centralized shop, but Phil, you remember when we were growing up, you'd go to the Apple reseller store, right? They'd have Apple there, but they'd also be selling, HP They had the sign out the front saying Apple reseller. So even Apple started in partnership before it became what it was today. So I remember doing one of those rah-rah business calls. I was speaking at it as Afterburner, but it was run by a guy. I won't say who it was, but it was one of those clappy, happy business communities, hundreds of people there. But he did say something really interesting, and it was, is it the fastest way to grow a business is through partnership. There is no other way that you'll accelerate at the speed of a partnership. And that's true. You know, like there's everyone has a gap in their product. So we partner with the likes of Korn Ferry. They're a leadership organization. We're an execution organization. So there is natural synergies to partner with organizations like that. And that is a genuine partnership. And it's not a partnership which is, I also remember with the company that ripped me off and ripped me and Tom off, the owner of that company always said to me, never joint venture, never do anything together. Don't ever, always own everything. And I believed that for a long time until I saw what actually happens when you're like that and everything falls into a heap. So I think partnership is, and this is, I think, the whole hack of life is the contentment in life and genuine happiness is a result of what you give, not what you get. And a partnership is the perfect opportunity for two people to give into a partnership and to both receive the abundance of that giving.
Couldn't agree more. Boo, I'm going to jump into our rapid fire in a second. But before we do that, I'm very interested for people to understand more about Afterburner. Where can they go and learn more about you and your work and the Afterburner team?
Afterburner.com is our world. There's a ton of stuff out there. I mean, we publish 8 books. The 9th book is just about to come out for Christmas. Flawless execution is a term that you'll hear. But if you just look for Afterburner Inc., most of our IP over the last 28 years is there or thereabouts. And because we transformed or we codified a model that the Air Force uses, and the Air Force still uses it, it's 60 years old now. It hasn't changed much. All we've done is simplify it even more. So go to Afterburner and you will find our world.
Love it. And we'll make sure we link in the show notes to all of those publications that are there. I'm very interested to see what comes out for Christmas in that new book as well. So, mate, let's go into these questions. You good to go?
Ready to go.
All right. Complete this sentence. Partnership is?
Abundance.
What content are you loving at the moment?
Mindset-related content and unpacking the complexity of mindset.
What's the worst piece of advice you've received and why?
Don't ever joint venture with anyone because it leads to a toxic, autocratic environment where no one's happy, only one person wins, and they're ultimately a loser.
I hear you. When you see potential for a new partnership, what's the first thing you do to turn that potential into action?
Be myself completely, warts and all. My language, my beliefs, wear your heart on your sleeve and see if the other person does the same thing.
And one last thing. What are you deeply grateful for right now?
I'm deeply grateful for going to that air show when I was 5 years of age. I turned 50 this year. I've spent 45 years immersed in fighter pilot mindset, and I have the back half of my life now to really unpack this mindset, this way of working, to prove it beyond any shadow of a doubt, and for other people to experience it and use it to kind of live the life that I've lived, which is a life where every single thing I've ever wanted to do, everything has come true. And I'm only 50. And anyone can do that if you just think differently.
That's amazing. And look, as someone who is not a former fighter pilot, but seems to surround himself with many of them, I feel as though that
Phil. It's there. You're already, you're one of the gifted few. You're an Elon Musk of the world. Some people just have it. You know, they just get it. They're outcome focused. Their belief systems are flexible, and they're really focused around bringing as many people on that journey with them as they can. So you just didn't have to do the $15 million worth of training, mate.
Well, it's a privilege nonetheless. Boo, thanks so much for giving me the time today, and I'm very excited about our next conversation.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it. Real pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the end of this episode of Partnership Plus. If you like what you heard, you can share this episode via text message. And if you'd like to build your business partnership muscle, my free weekly newsletter called Wednesday Partnership will help you do just that. You'll find a link in the show notes. Finally, I'm big on encouragement and love to see people be in motion towards their ambitions. So if you know someone who might be struggling, reach out to them with a quick message of encouragement. It could change their life. Thanks again, and I'll see you in the next episode.